Abdullahi, how's life in Iran, and would you recommend other students to come and study here?
The life in Iran is relatively good in many, many aspects. Although there are some economic sanctions that has been inflicted on the government and other individuals, but still, people, due to the good governance, people feel the presence of government, especially in the part of transport and the food subsidy that is being provided.
Okay, now our time is running out. So our last question, Mr. Abdullahi, briefly tell us, what suggestions do you have for improved academic ties between Iran and Africa?
Okay, due to the fact that there are some similarities between Iran and Africa, but due to these similarities, it is very, very important for the nations of Africa and to have a cooperation, educational cooperation with Iran in the parts of education, because any national development is dependent on the education or education development of the country. So therefore, we are supposed to have a very good and standard education so that our nations are developed.
Well, I would like to thank Hassan Abdullahi, a Nigerian PhD student at the Faculty of Biology, University of Tehran. We now take a short break before the next segment of our show on Africa's strategic minerals. Stay with us.
Africa's strategic minerals. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Africa is rich in strategic minerals such as lithium, graphite, bauxite, manganese, and cobalt, all essential for modern technologies. However, harnessing the value of these minerals requires investment in infrastructure, innovation, and sustainable practices, and developing the local industrial fabric.
These were some of the topics discussed at the African Mining Indaba 2024 that was held last February in Cape Town. The term Indaba comes from the Zulu language, which means a meeting to discuss a serious topic. This year, the Indaba is dedicated to the capitalization and development of mining in Africa.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa addressed this world's largest mining investment conference. He said that the vast majority of minerals that are key to the global energy transition lie beneath Africa's rich soil.
The vast majority of the minerals that are key to global energy transition lie beneath the soil of the African continent, as you have heard my two brothers articulating earlier. These include manganese, iron ore, copper, cobalt, nickel, and the platinum group's metals as well. Africa has the potential to be the fulcrum of the global energy transition, with mining at its core.
To discuss the mining sector in Africa, we have contacted Matthew Parks, the acting national spokesperson and parliamentary coordinator of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU. Africa is now at the forefront of a transformative era as the world shifts towards sustainable energy sources. The continent's rich minerals reserves are emerging as a prerequisite for the global green technology revolution. Our first question to Matthew Parks, do you think there is enough political realization across Africa on the immense potential the continent holds in transforming the world?
No, we don't think so. I think in most countries across Africa, there isn't enough focus on it. There's not enough focus on many economic developmental issues or on the role the state should play in terms of trying to grow the economy. But I think if you look at the reports, most African countries really don't focus much on the issue of not just exporting raw minerals, which they do, but on beneficiating on, you know, investing in them locally to finish, you know, to export a finished raw product. So most African countries really don't spend much time focusing on that, to be honest.
There is no doubt that Africa needs to tap on the continent's strategic mineral wealth for development, particularly by adding value by processing minerals before export.
So there's a need to look at beneficiating, to appreciate the importance of doing so, but also to kind of put in place the necessary investments from the state side to help facilitate that, to also create the partnerships between the public and the private sector to ensure that it does happen as well. Sometimes it does also require the state to put in place, for example, tax incentives or legislative requirements so it can happen. I think there's a need for the state just to take a much more proactive and much more creative approach, because almost all African governments have really played little more than lip service to this issue.
Developing countries, especially in Africa, which boasts 19% of global mineral reserves needed for EVs, stand to benefit from the green boom if they can process the minerals locally. Zimbabwe's government banned raw lithium exports in 2022 as it seeks to get more value from the mineral. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa speaks during the opening of a lithium processing plant in the country.
Lithium is the mineral of the present and the future. Hence, its beneficiation and a value addition by Prospect Lithium Zimbabwe will position our country as an emerging and competitive player in the global lithium value chain world over.
Now, despite facing sanctions from Western countries, Zimbabwe took this historic decision to process lithium in the country. Mr. Parks, what's your take on this?
No, it's a positive decision. It's a decision that other African countries should look at and see how they can emulate that example. South Africa has also made similar, you know, calls, commitments to do so previously as well. So it's a positive example. All African countries should look at it. For minerals, for petroleum exports, for other exports. It's an example that other countries across the world do it, whether it's in the Middle East or Asia, and it's something we should really be looking to do, not just have it as a commitment, but actually to implement it as well.
Speaking during the world's largest mining investment conference, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa spoke of persistent challenges impeding mining performance.
We are all acutely aware that we face strong headwinds and a number of persistent challenges are impeding mining performance. Globally, commodity prices are volatile, high energy prices, the geopolitical tensions that continue to prevail around the world continue to cause enormous challenges. And the global cost of living crisis is also playing a significant role in dampening the business operating environment.
And now, next question to Mr. Parks. What, in your opinion, are some of the challenges South Africa faces in its mining sector?
The challenge one is to actually, you know, to put in place the necessary infrastructure to beneficiate locally, to put in place the necessary technology and the skills, the business partnerships, to avail the resources, the financial resources to do so as well. It also means to create the export markets too. And really, we haven't done that. And I think we really need to find a way to make it profitable for businesses to do so, but I think also just to kind of compel them. But not only that, I think also put in place tax incentives to help make it even more attractive for them, because there will be some costs, but also to put in place the necessary tax penalties if they don't do so, and also the legislative requirements for them to do so as well.
A Bloomberg NEF study recently noted the cost of manufacturing lithium-ion battery precursors is 3 times lower in Africa than in the United States, China, or Poland. There is concern that multinationals are not doing enough to transfer technology to African countries.
And I think simply because maybe they find it easier to do so in the countries where they set up operations, perhaps they view African countries as being unstable. You might also find that their own countries' governments and shareholders put pressure on them as well. But again, I think it's just another additional reason why we should also put a bit of effort into it.
Since the days of the slave trade and colonialism, we have seen frequent and successful European attempts of hampering economic development in Africa.
Experts believe EU's policies on critical raw materials show the intent of renewing colonial cycles of exploitation and subordination by exploiting Africa's mineral resources. Now, our last question to Mr. Parks. Will Africa really be able to free itself from exploitation at this time when the world needs green energy minerals that are mostly in Africa?
If we don't show leadership, then those patterns will continue. It really requires governments to be much more thoughtful, to really be much more forward-looking about the continent's development, because the continent has not developed much since independence over 60 years ago. And yes, we can blame the West, that's fine. The West is doing what's in the West's interest. Africa also needs to do what's in Africa's interest, and most of the African governments for many years have just not paid attention, have been happy not to do it. So I think it requires a leadership shift in African countries to take this thing much more seriously. Otherwise, we will continue to stumble along as a poverty-stricken continent. And we simply need to look at the examples of many other countries, whether it's China or South Korea or Japan or Malaysia, who have really shown, even other countries across the Middle East too, to take control of the resources and to use it in a way which benefits that country's long-term socioeconomic development. Our resources are not unlimited. Eventually, you run out of a particular mineral or petroleum resource. And I think it shows that smart governments prepare for that economic transition. And I think, unfortunately, most African countries are not doing so. In fact, often when these commodities booms take place, they just simply go for the shortest route, often the least profitable route. And it's a really missed opportunity.
Well, there you have it. Only forward-looking leaders will enable Africa to reap the benefits presented by the global need for strategic minerals in the continent. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
The World Health Organization, WHO, has raised the alarm over the inhumane humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, which continues to deteriorate as the Israeli regime bombs keep falling on the besieged territory. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Middle East Eye has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations reports gross human rights violations, including possible war crimes during the Israeli regime's ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. The United Nations Human Rights Office provided the information on Friday, 23rd of February, in its annual report. The Israeli regime has been waging the military onslaught since 7th of October last year, in response to Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, a surprise offensive staged by Gaza's resistance groups against the occupied Palestinian territories. The Israeli regime has simultaneously been employing an all-out siege against Gaza, preventing the flow of water, food, electricity, and medical supplies into the territory. So far, the war has massacred tens of thousands of innocent people, many of them women and children. The United Nations report said the Israeli onslaught has led to massive suffering of Palestinians, including through the massacring of civilians on a broad scale, extensive, repeated displacement of people, destruction of homes and the denial of sufficient food and other essentials for life. The United Nations report added, "The blockade and siege imposed on Gaza amount to collective punishment, and may also amount to the use of starvation as a method of war, which are all war crimes." The report identified three emblematic Israeli strikes, two on the Jabalia refugee camp and one on Gaza City, which led to massive casualties and material damage. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, said, "Launching an indiscriminate attack resulting in death or injury to civilians, or an attack in the knowledge that it will cause extensive, incidental civilian loss, injury or damage, are all war crimes." In a broader context, the UN official reflected on the Israeli regime's decades-long occupation of the Palestinian territories. Volker Turk said, "The entrenched impunity reported by our office for decades cannot be permitted to continue. There must be accountability for violations seen over 56 years of Israeli occupation and the 16 years of blockade of the Gaza Strip." The Israeli regime came into existence in 1948 after occupying huge swathes of Palestinian territories during a Western-backed war. It occupied more land and in particular the West Bank of the River Jordan, including the city of Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, in another such war in 1967. Ever since, it has built hundreds of settlements upon the overrun territories and deployed the most aggressive restrictions on the movement of Palestinian population there. Tel Aviv withdrew from Gaza in 2005, but has been keeping the territory under an all-out land, aerial and naval siege since 2006. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Brazilian president has repeated his recent assertion that the Israeli regime is committing genocide in the Gaza Strip, braving the repercussions that have come to affect his country's ties with the Israeli regime and its main ally, the United States. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said at an event in Rio de Janeiro on Friday, 23rd of February, "What Israel is doing is not a war, it is genocide, because it is massacring women and children." President Lula da Silva added, "It is a genocide. Thousands of children are dead and thousands are missing. Soldiers are not dying. Women and children are dying at the hospital. If that's not genocide, I don't know what genocide is." President Lula da Silva, who once again spoke in favor of the creation of a free and sovereign Palestinian state, said, "I do not exchange my dignity for falsehood." No earlier than on Sunday, 18th of February, President Lula da Silva had unequivocally lambasted the Israeli regime's savagery in its military aggression against the coastal territory, which has so far claimed tens of thousands of Palestinian lives, many of them women and children. Addressing an African Union summit in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, President Lula da Silva said, "What's happening in Gaza isn't a war, it's genocide. It's not a war of soldiers against soldiers, it's a war between a highly prepared army and women and children." The Brazilian Foreign Ministry confirmed afterwards that the country's ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories had been recalled for consultations, adding that it had also summoned the Israeli envoy to Brasilia. This is not the first time that the Brazilian president has singled out the Israeli regime for criticism since the onset of its military onslaught on Gaza. Speaking after a meeting with his Egyptian counterpart Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Cairo recently, President Lula da Silva said Israel's behavior in Gaza has no explanation. The Brazilian president added, "With the pretext of fighting the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, Israel is massacring women and children." Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The World Health Organization, the WHO, has raised the alarm over the inhumane humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, which continues to deteriorate as the Israeli regime bombs keep falling on the besieged territory. The World Health Organization chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, called for an immediate halt to Israeli war crimes in Gaza and demanded unhindered access to international aid for the population of Gaza. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Gaza has become a death zone. Much of the territory has been destroyed. The head of the United Nations Health Agency also criticized the Israeli regime's military forces for bombing hospitals and medical facilities in Gaza. He said, "What type of world do we live in when hospitals must close because there is no more power or medicine to help save patients and they're being targeted by military forces?" Ghebreyesus also expressed concern about severe malnutrition amongst the population of Gaza, which has shot up dramatically since the war started, from under 1% to more than 15% in some areas, putting more lives at risk. Also, the United Nations staff members who help evacuate critically wounded patients from Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza Strip have described appalling conditions in the territory's second largest medical facility, saying it has turned into a place of death. Jonathan Withall, a senior humanitarian affairs officer at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, in the occupied Palestinian territory, said, "The conditions are appalling. There are dead bodies in the corridors of the hospital. Patients are in a desperate situation. This has become a place of death, not a place of healing." Jonathan Whittle, who took part in evacuation missions along with teams from the World Health Organization and the Palestine Red Crescent Society on 18th and 19th of February, raised concern about conditions of dozens of patients and staff who remain trapped inside the hospital building amid intensified Israeli bombardment.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this was Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions there. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917 when mustard gas is used for the first time and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. Find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded, and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that C is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the master gas decomposes to thiodeglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites collecting fish, cod mainly, and what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects like organic contaminants, heavy metals and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up, and therefore we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying in fact the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you load in there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical contaminations. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on a
investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases. When I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea, there are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm.
And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Jordanians have rallied for Gaza from Amman to the occupied Palestine border, calling an end to the occupation and their government's normalization with the Zionist entity. Furthermore, they are protesting their government's trade routes with the occupying entity, even forming human chains to block the land corridor created to sustain Israel. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more.
Press TV wrote, throughout the week, Jordan's Air Force, with the approval of the Zionist regime, delivered aid via airdrop to people in the besieged Gaza Strip. The move was widely hailed as heroic. Overseen by Jordan's King Abdullah II, the aid was dropped in large pallets of items, which included goods like ready-to-eat meals, medical supplies, and other items. These pallets were delivered through several airplane drops, causing a rush of Palestinians to flee throughout the Gaza Strip to gain access to the boxes. The airdrop itself was also used as a media opportunity for the king, who was filmed dropping parcels while awkwardly posing for cameras. Though some aid was received by hungry and desperate Gazans, many parcels simply went missing, particularly in North Gaza, where acute food shortages have caused death by starvation. Parcels, despite being waterproof, were purportedly dropped into the Mediterranean Sea far beyond reach, or even fell into the Gaza envelope, which can effectively only be accessed by Zionist settlers and military. For the parcels dropping into the sea within reach, rowboats had to be deployed to gather the precious aid. If Gazans go beyond a specific point in the sea, they are targeted by Zionist naval forces, which have been given shoot-to-kill orders. Unfortunately, some of these parcels will never be received by any needy Palestinian. Other pallets landed in locations where the Zionist regime is enacting a full entry block for Palestinians. Even if the aid drop landed in an accessible street or rooftop, the occupation army would murder anyone who went to it, as they have demonstrated with what is now known as the Flower Massacre. The massacre occurred when Zionist forces opened fire on Palestinians accessing designated aid trucks full of food for hungry Gazans. Over 100 were murdered and many more were injured. The massacre has been met with global condemnation of the Zionist regime, which has deflected and denied accusations of opening fire, despite documented footage of Israeli regime troops doing exactly that. Airdrops are a last resort for dispersing aid. They are ineffective, uncoordinated, and ultimately unable to predict exactly where the aid will land. Consider this with the fact that if Zionist troops are willing to open fire on designated air trucks, traveling to a parachuted pellet is even more dangerous. Many have criticized King Abdullah II for using these aid drops as a self-serving and self-promotional opportunity, particularly because, in contrast to Palestinian aid, the Jordanian regime has not restricted any economic activity with the Zionist regime. In fact, it has surged. Though Jordan is not part of the Abraham Accords, it is in practice a state that has normalized economic and some political ties with the Tel Aviv regime. So much so that, despite the carnage in Gaza since October 7th, Jordanian exports to the Zionist regime have increased, with no signs of boycott or sanctions to condemn what's unfolding in the besieged Strip. Jordan and the Zionist regime have been the beneficiaries of economic cooperation brokered by Arab regimes such as the UAE, which signed the Abraham Accords. For example, Jordan and the Zionist regime have partnered in an unpopular energy deal meant to further a process of normalization between them. There is also the shocking export of fruits and vegetables from Jordan to the occupied territories. media source. Arabi Post revealed that Jordan was the second highest exporter of most fruits and vegetables to the Israeli-occupied territories from October 7, 2023 to February 11, 2024, second only to Turkey. These two countries constitute 55% of total fruits and vegetables that the Zionist regime imported globally. Even more insultingly, Jordan is the final leg of the land corridor set up by some traitorous Arab states to circumvent the blockade enacted by Yemen in solidarity with Gaza. The reality is stark. While Gazans have to rush to airdropped pallets as they starve, often while dodging Israeli sniper and tank fire, Zionist settlers get Jordanian commodities delivered right to their markets for easy consumption. The Jordanian regime is in one of the best positions to hold the Zionist entity. It shares a massive border with the occupied territories, controls a chunk of imports Israel receives from the east, and produces commodities for the occupation entity. Yet Jordan instead works hand in hand with the Zionist regime to coordinate airdrops that are ineffective for Gazans, who are facing genocide, all the while working against resistance factions by hosting U.S. military bases and allowing its roads to deliver products to the Zionist entity. It cannot be overstated that we must separate the Jordanian regime from the Jordanian people. Jordanians have rallied for Gaza from Amman to the occupied Palestine border, calling an end to the occupation and their government's normalization with the Zionist entity. Furthermore, they are protesting their government's trade routes with the occupying entity, even forming human chains to block the land corridor created to sustain Israel. Finally, we must reckon with the most obvious reality. King Abdullah II and the Jordanian Air Force could not have had their photo shoot opportunity without the blessing of the US and the Zionist regime, which ultimately means that these airdrops play into the very hands of the Zionist regime. By allowing for ineffective airdrops, Israel, who is facing allegations of genocide at the International Court of Justice, can simply say they are not committing genocide because they allow countries to help aid the starving Palestinians. Meanwhile, the same aid that is dropped is either impossible to reach or Palestinians must risk their lives under gunfire and starvation to obtain it. It is a mix of political and media manipulation meant to obscure the reality on the ground. Access to aid is systematically prevented as Gazans are being starved and hospitals are being shut down. Jordan is ideally placed to put an end to Israeli bloodthirst, but it seems the king has prioritized flashy videos and normalization over the fate of the Palestinian people and the region.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the commander-in-chief of Iran's armed forces, Imam Khamenei. Martyr Soleimani revived the resistance front and its strengthening must continue. December 31st, 2023. She, Zainab Soleimani, asked me to give her a word of advice. Very well, this is my advice. Be sincere in the things you do. In other words, don't let your egoism interfere with your intentions and your actions. Sincerity means working only for God. Wherever you have uncertainties about your egoism, distance yourself from that. In other words, it is better for a person to step away from a task rather than to do it in order to be seen. This is one point. The point about his sincerity. One point about the value of Martyr Soleimani's work, which has been and continues to be spoken about, is his role in reviving the resistance front in the region. This is a point that needs to be paid attention to. Of course, if someone is to speak about this, it should be spoken about correctly. Martyr Soleimani has played an important role in reviving the resistance front in the region, a very important role.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes we see there is a resistant group in a region. Well, yes, these existed before Martyr Soleimani as well. But there is a time when a front is created. This is what we always wanted. If the opposing side creates a front, this side must also create a front. If it weren't for this front, Gaza would not have been able to resist all this time. This resistance front gives strength to all aspects of the issue. If, for instance, four or five different groups unite, their power and strength will be more than five times as much as each individual group alone. A new identity will emerge. This new identity is very important. Martyr Qasim Soleimani played a significant role in this matter, and he worked very hard for it. People had seen his presence in the mountains of Syria, his fearlessness, and him moving toward danger. This is very important, but the main significance is that these trips, his presence, and these efforts were able to revive and strengthen the resistance front. May God exalt his rank. He pursued this work with forethought, with resourcefulness, with wisdom, with a moral behavior, with energy, and with endless effort. And this was and is very important. I hope that this movement continues by the will of God. Of course, now commander of the IRGC Quds Force is truly and honestly moving very well. Praise God, his endeavors are very good. This path of strengthening the resistance front, which Martyr Soleimani was very active in and very outstanding at, should be continued by the will of God.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.